This is Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. This is the first of three parts of Chapter 6, entitled The Fire This Time.
Shortly after sunrise on September 20, 2007, more than 10,000 protesters had already descended on Jenna, Louisiana, a small town of about 3,000 people. Because of the congestion on the roads to Jenna, some protesters left their vehicles and walked into town on foot. Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and Martin Luther King III were among those who traveled hundreds of miles to participate in what was heralded as the beginnings of the new civil rights movement. Black youth turned out to protest in record numbers, joined by rappers Mos Def, Ice Cube, and Salt-N-Pepa. National news media swarmed the town. Cameras rolled as thousands of protesters from all over the country poured into the rural community to condemn the attempted murder charges filed against six black teenagers who allegedly beat a white classmate at a local high school. This was no ordinary schoolyard fight. Many believed the attack was related to a string of racially charged conflicts and controversies at the school, most notably the hanging of nooses from a tree in the school's main courtyard. Reverend Al Sharpton captured the spirit of the protest when he stated boldly, "We've gone from plantations to penitentiaries. They have tried to create a criminal justice system that particularly targets our young black men, and now we sit and stand in a city that says it's a prank to hang a hangman's noose, but that it's attempted murder to have a fight. We cannot sit by silently. That's why we came, and that's why we intend to keep coming." For a moment, the nation's eyes were trained on the plight of the Jenna Six, and debates could be heard in barbershops, in cafes, and in lines at grocery stores about whether the criminal justice system was, in fact, biased against black men, or whether the black teens got exactly what they deserved for a brutal attack on a defenseless young white teen. Grim statistics about the number of black men in prison were trotted out, and commentators argued over whether those numbers reflected crime rates or bias, and whether white teens would ever be charged with attempted murder and tried as adults if they attacked a black kid in a schoolyard fight. The uprising on behalf of the six black teens paid off. Although the prosecutor refused to back down from his decision to bring adult charges against the youths, an appellate court ultimately ruled the teens had to be tried as juveniles, and many of the charges were reduced or dropped. While this result undoubtedly cheered the thousands of Jenna 6 supporters around the country, the spectacle may have been oddly unsettling to parents of children imprisoned for far less serious crimes, including those locked up for minor drug offenses. Where were the protesters and civil rights leaders when their children were tried as adults and carted off to adult prisons? Where was the national news media then? Their children were accused of no crimes of violence, no acts of cruelty, yet they faced adult criminal charges and the prospect of serving years, perhaps decades, behind bars for possessing or selling illegal drugs, crimes that go largely ignored when committed by white youth. Why the outpouring of support and the promises of a new civil rights movement on behalf of the Jenna youth, but not their children? If there had been no nooses hanging from a schoolyard tree, there would have been no Jenna 6, no mass protests, no live coverage on CNN. The decision to charge six black teens as adults with attempted murder in connection with a schoolyard fight was understood as possibly racist by the mainstream media and some protesters, only because of the sensational fact that nooses were first hung from a tree. It was this relic, the noose, showing up so brazenly and leading to a series of racially charged conflicts and controversies that made it possible for the news media and the country as a whole to entertain the possibility that these six youths may well have been treated to Jim Crow justice. It was this evidence of old-fashioned racism that made it possible for a new generation of protesters to frame the attempted murder charges against the six black teens in a manner that mainstream America would understand as racist. Ironically, it was precisely this framing that ensured that the events in Jenna would not actually launch a new civil rights movement. A new civil rights movement cannot be organized around the relics of the earlier system of control if it is to address meaningfully the racial realities of our time. Any racial justice movement, to be successful, must vigorously challenge the public consensus that underlies the prevailing system of control. Nooses, racial slurs, and overt bigotry are widely condemned by people across the political spectrum. They are understood to be remnants of the past, no longer reflective of the prevailing public consensus about race. Challenging these forms of racism is certainly necessary, as we must always remain vigilant, but it will do little to shake the foundations of the current system of control. The new caste system, unlike its predecessors, is officially colorblind. We must deal with it on its own terms. Rethinking Denial, or Where Are Civil Rights Advocates When You Need Them? Dealing with this system on its own terms is complicated by the problem of denial. Few Americans today recognize mass incarceration for what it is, a new caste system thinly veiled by the cloak of colorblindness. Hundreds of thousands of people of color are swept into this system and released every year. Yet we rationalize the systemic discrimination and exclusion and turn a blind eye to the suffering. Our collective denial is not merely an inconvenient fact, it's a major stumbling block to public understanding of the role of race in our society, and it sharply limits the opportunities for truly transformative collective action. The general public's collective denial is fairly easy to forgive, if not excuse, for all the reasons discussed in Chapter 5. The awkward silence of the civil rights community, however, is more problematic. If something akin to a racial caste system truly exists, why has the civil rights community been so slow to acknowledge it? Indeed, how could civil rights organizations, some of which are larger and better funded than at any point in American history, have allowed this human rights nightmare to occur on their watch? The answer is not that civil rights advocates are indifferent to racial bias in the criminal justice system. To the contrary, we care quite a lot. Nor have we been entirely ignorant of the realities of the new caste system. In recent years, civil rights activists have launched important reform efforts, most notably the campaigns challenging felon disenfranchisement laws, crack sentencing policies, and racial profiling by law enforcement. Civil rights groups have also developed litigation and important coalitions related to the school-to-prison pipeline, inadequate indigent defense, and juvenile justice reform, to name a few. Despite these important efforts, what is most striking about civil rights communities' response to the mass incarceration of people of color is the relative quiet. Given the magnitude, the sheer scale of the new Jim Crow, one would expect that the war on drugs would be the top priority of every civil rights organization in the country. Conferences, strategy sessions, and debates regarding how best to build a movement to dismantle the new caste system would be occurring on a regular basis. Major grassroots organizing efforts would be underway in nearly every state and city nationwide. Foundations would be lobbied to prioritize criminal justice reform. Media campaigns would be unleashed in an effort to overturn the punitive public consensus on race. The rhetoric associated with specific reform efforts would stress the need to end mass incarceration, not merely tinker with it, and efforts would be made to build multiracial coalitions, based on the understanding that the racial politics that gave birth to the war on drugs have harmed poor and working class whites as well as people of color. All of that could have happened, but it didn't. Why not? Part of the answer is that civil rights organizations, like all institutions, are comprised of fallible human beings. The prevailing public consensus affects everyone, including civil rights advocates. Those of us in the civil rights community are not immune to the racial stereotypes that pervade media imagery and political rhetoric, nor do we operate outside of the political context. Like most people, we tend to resist believing that we might be part of the problem. One day, civil rights organizations may be embarrassed by how long it took them to move out of denial and to do the hard work necessary to end mass incarceration. Rather than blaming civil rights groups, however, it's far more productive to understand the reasons why the response to mass incarceration has been so constrained. Again, it's not that civil rights advocates don't care, we do. And it's not just that we're afflicted by unconscious racial bias and stereotypes about those behind bars. Civil rights organizations have reasons for their constraint, reasons that no longer make good sense, even if they once did. A bit of civil rights history may be helpful here. Civil rights advocacy has not always looked the way it does today. Throughout most of our nation's history, from the days of the abolitionist movement through the civil rights movement, racial justice advocacy has generally revolved around grassroots organizing and the strategic mobilization of public opinion. In recent years, however, a bit of mythology has sprung up regarding the centrality of litigation to racial justice struggles. The success of the brilliant legal crusade that led to Brown v. Board of Education has created a widespread perception that civil rights lawyers are the most important players in racial justice advocacy. This image was enhanced following the passage of the Civil Rights Acts of 1965, when civil rights lawyers became embroiled in highly visible and controversial efforts to end hiring discrimination, create affirmative action plans, and enforce school desegregation orders. As public attention shifted from the streets to the courtroom, the extraordinary grassroots movement that made civil rights legislation possible faded from public view. the lawyers took over. With all deliberate speed, civil rights organizations became professionalized and increasingly disconnected from the communities they claimed to represent. Legal scholar and former NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyer Derek Bell was among the first to critique this phenomenon, arguing in a 1976 Yale Law Journal article that civil rights lawyers were pursuing their own agendas in school desegregation cases, even when they conflicted with their clients' expressed desires. 2 decades later, former NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyer and current Harvard Law School professor Lanny Guinier published a memoir in which she acknowledged that, by the early 1990s, civil rights litigators like me had become like the Washington insiders we were so suspicious of. We reflexively distanced ourselves from the very people on whose behalf we brought the cases in the first place. This shift, she noted, had profound consequences for the future of racial justice advocacy. In fact, it was debilitating to the movement. Instead of a moral crusade, the movement became an almost purely legal crusade. Civil rights advocates pursued their own agendas as unelected representatives of communities defined by race, and displayed considerable skill navigating courtrooms and halls of power across America. The law became what the lawyers and lobbyists said it was, with little or no input from the people whose fate hung in the balance. Guinier continued, "In charge, we channeled a passion for change into legal negotiations and lawsuits. We defined the issues in terms of developing legal doctrine and establishing legal precedent. Our clients became important, but secondary, players in a formal arena that required lawyers to translate lay claims into technical speech. We then disembodied plaintiffs' claims in judicially manageable or judicially enforceable terms, unenforceable without more lawyers. Simultaneously, the movement's center of gravity shifted to Washington, D.C. as lawyers and national pundits became more prominent than clients and citizens. We isolated ourselves from the people who were our anchor and on whose behalf we had labored. We not only left people behind, we also lost touch with the moral force at the heart of the movement itself." Not surprisingly, as civil rights advocates converted a grassroots movement into a legal campaign, and as civil rights leaders became political insiders, many civil rights organizations became top-heavy with lawyers. This development enhanced their ability to wage legal battles, but impeded their ability to acknowledge or respond to the emergence of a new caste system. Lawyers have a tendency to identify and concentrate on problems they know how to solve, i.e., problems that can be solved through litigation. The mass incarceration of people of color is not that kind of problem. Widespread preoccupation with litigation, however, is not the only or even the main reason civil rights groups have shied away from challenging the new caste system. Challenging mass incarceration requires something civil rights advocates have long been reluctant to do: advocacy on behalf of criminals. Even at the height of Jim Crow segregation, when black men were more likely to be lynched than to receive a fair trial in the South, NAACP lawyers were reluctant to advocate on behalf of blacks accused of crimes unless the lawyers were convinced of the men's innocence. The major exception was anti-death penalty advocacy. Over the years, civil rights lawyers have made heroic efforts to save the lives of condemned criminals. But outside of the death penalty arena, civil rights advocates have long been reluctant to leap to the defense of accused criminals. Advocates have found that they are most successful when they draw attention to certain types of black people, those who are easily understood by mainstream whites as good and respectable, and tell certain types of stories about them. Since the days when abolitionists struggled to eradicate slavery, racial justice advocates have gone to great lengths to identify black people who defy racial stereotypes, and they've exercised considerable message discipline, telling only those stories of racial injustice that will evoke sympathy among whites. A prime example is the Rosa Parks story. Rosa Parks was not the first person to refuse to give up her seat on a segregated bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Civil rights advocates considered and rejected 2 other black women as plaintiffs when planning a test case challenging segregation practices, Claudette Colvin and Mary Louise Smith. Both of them were arrested for refusing to give up their seats on Montgomery's segregated buses, just months before Rosa Parks refused to budge. Colvin was 15 years old when she defied segregation laws. Her case attracted national attention, but civil rights advocates declined to use her as a plaintiff because she got pregnant by an older man shortly after her arrest. Advocates worried that her immoral conduct would detract from or undermine their efforts to show that blacks were entitled to and worthy of equal treatment. Likewise, they decided not to use Mary Louise Smith as a plaintiff because her father was rumored to be an alcoholic. It was understood that, in any effort to challenge racial discrimination, the litigant, and even the litigant's family, had to be above reproach and free from every negative trait that could be used as a justification for unequal treatment. Rosa Parks, in this regard, was a dream come true. She was, in the words of Joanne Gibson Robinson, another key figure in the Montgomery bus boycott, a medium-sized, cultured mulatto woman, a civic and religious worker, quiet, unassuming, and pleasant in manner and appearance, dignified and reserved, of high morals and strong character. No one doubted that Parks was the perfect symbol for the movement to integrate public transportation in Montgomery. Martin Luther King Jr. recalled in his memoir that Mrs. Parks was ideal for the role assigned to her by history, largely because her character was impeccable and she was one of the most respected people in the Negro community. The time-tested strategy of using those who epitomize moral virtue as symbols in racial struggle campaigns is far more difficult to employ in efforts to reform the criminal justice system. Most people who are caught up in the criminal justice system have less than flawless backgrounds. While many black people get stopped and searched for crimes they did not commit, it's not so easy these days to find young black men in urban areas who have never been convicted of a crime. The new caste system labels black and brown men as criminals early, often in their teens, making them damaged goods from the perspective of traditional civil rights advocates. With criminal records, the majority of young black men in urban areas are not seen as attractive plaintiffs for civil rights litigation or good poster boys for media advocacy. The widespread aversion to advocacy on behalf of those labeled criminals reflects a certain political reality. Many would argue that expending scarce resources on criminal justice reform is a strategic mistake. After all, criminals are the one social group in America that nearly everyone, across political, racial, and class boundaries, feels free to hate. Why champion the cause of the despised when there are so many sympathetic stories about racial injustice one could tell? Why draw public attention to the worst of the black community, those labeled criminals? Shouldn't we direct scarce resources to battles that are more easily won, such as affirmative action? Shouldn't we force the public's attention on the so-called root causes of mass incarceration, such as educational inequality? We can continue along this road. It's a road well traveled, but we must admit the strategy has not made much of a difference. African Americans as a group are no better off than they were in 1968 in many respects. In fact, to some extent, they're worse off. When the incarcerated population is counted in unemployment and poverty rates, the best of times for the rest of America have been among the worst of times for African Americans, particularly black men. As sociologist Bruce Western has shown, the notion that the 1990s, the Clinton years, were good times for African Americans and that a rising tide lifts all boats is pure fiction. And as unemployment rates sank to historically low levels in the late 1990s for the general population, jobless rates among non-college black men in their 20s rose to their highest levels ever, propelled by skyrocketing incarceration rates. One reason so many people have a false impression of the economic well-being of African Americans as a group is that poverty and unemployment statistics do not include people who are behind bars. Prisoners are literally erased from the nation's economic picture, leading standard estimates to underestimate the true jobless rate by as much as 24 percentage points for less educated black men. Young African American men were the only group to experience a steep increase in joblessness between 1980 and 2000, a development directly traceable to the increase in the penal population. During the much-heralded economic boom of the 1990s, the true jobless rate among non-college black men was a staggering 42%, 65% among black male dropouts. Despite these inconvenient truths, though, we can press on. We can continue to ignore those labeled criminals in our litigation and media advocacy and focus public attention on more attractive plaintiffs, like innocent doctors and lawyers stopped and searched on freeways, innocent black and brown schoolchildren attending abysmal schools, or innocent middle and upper class black children who will be denied access to Harvard, Michigan, and Yale if affirmative action disappears. We can continue on this well-worn path, but if we do, we should labor under no illusions that we will end mass incarceration or shake the foundations of the current racial order. We may improve some school districts, prolong affirmative action for another decade or two, or force some police departments to condemn racial profiling, but we will not put a dent in the prevailing caste system. We must face the realities of the new caste system and embrace those who are most oppressed by it, if we hope to end the new Jim Crow. That said, no effort is made here to describe in any detail what should or should not be done in the months and years ahead to challenge the new caste system. Such an undertaking is beyond the scope of this book. The aim of this chapter is simply to reflect on whether traditional approaches to racial justice advocacy are adequate to the task at hand. What follows is not a plan, but several questions and claims offered for serious consideration by those committed to racial justice and interested in dismantling mass incarceration. They are offered as conversation starters, food for thought, debate, and, I hope, collective action. Each is a challenge to conventional wisdom or traditional strategies. Far more should be said about each point made, but as indicated, this is meant to be the beginning of a conversation, not an end. Tinkering is for mechanics, not racial justice advocates. The first and arguably most important point is that criminal justice reform efforts, standing alone, are futile. Gains can be made, yes, but the new caste system will not be overthrown by isolated victories in legislatures or courtrooms. If you doubt this is the case, consider the sheer scale of mass incarceration. If we hope to return to the rate of incarceration of the 1970s, a time when many civil rights activists believe rates of imprisonment were egregiously high, we would need to release approximately 4 out of 5 people currently behind bars today. Prisons would have to be closed across America, an event that would likely inspire panic in rural communities that have become dependent on prisons for jobs and economic growth. Hundreds of thousands of people, many of them unionized, would lose their jobs. As Mark Maurer has observed, the more than 700,000 prison and jail guards, administrators, service workers, and other personnel represent a potentially powerful political opposition to any scaling down of the system. One need only recall the fierce opposition to the closing of military bases in recent years to see how these forces will function over time. Arguably, Maurer underestimates the scope of the challenge by focusing narrowly on the prison system rather than counting all of the people employed in the criminal justice bureaucracy. According to a report released by the U.S. Department of Justice's Bureau of Statistics in 2006, the U.S. spent a record $185 billion for police protection, detention, judicial, and legal activities in 2003. Adjusting for inflation, these figures reflect a tripling of justice expenditures since 1982. The justice system employed almost 2.4 million people in 2003, 58% of them at the local level and 31% at the state level. If 4 out of 5 people were released from prisons, far more than 1 million people could lose their jobs. There's also the private sector investment to consider. Prisons are big business and have become deeply entrenched in America's economic and political system. Rich and powerful people, including former Vice President Dick Cheney, have invested millions in private prisons. They're deeply interested in expanding the market, increasing the supply of prisoners, not eliminating the pool of people who can be held captive for profit. The 2005 annual report for the Corrections Corporation of America explained the vested interests of private prisons matter-of-factly in a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Our growth is generally dependent upon our ability to obtain new contracts to develop and manage new correctional and detention facilities. This possible growth depends on a number of factors we cannot control, including crime rates and sentencing patterns in various jurisdictions and acceptance of privatization. The demand for our facilities and services could be adversely affected by the relaxation of enforcement efforts, leniency in conviction and sentencing practices, or through the decriminalization of certain activities that are currently proscribed by our criminal laws. For instance, any changes with respect to drugs and controlled substances or illegal immigration could affect the number of persons arrested, convicted, and sentenced, thereby potentially reducing demand for correctional facilities to house them. American Correctional Association President Gwendolyn Chun put the matter more bluntly that same year when lamenting that the unprecedented prison expansion boom of the 1990s seemed to be leveling off. "We'll have a hard time holding on to what we have now," she lamented. As it turns out, her fears were unfounded. Although prison growth appeared to be slowing in 2005, the market for prisoners has continued to expand. The nation's prison population broke new records in 2008 with no end in sight. The nonprofit PEW Charitable Trusts reports that inmate populations in at least 10 states are expected to increase by 25% or more between 2006 and 2011. In short, the market for private prisons is as good as it has ever been. Damon Hininger, the president and chief operations officer of Corrections Corporation of America, the largest private prison operator in the United States, is thoroughly optimistic. His company boosted net income by 14% in 2008, and he fully expects the growth to continue. "There's going to be a larger opportunity for us in the future," he said. Even beyond private prison companies, a whole range of prison profiteers must be reckoned with if mass incarceration is to be undone, including phone companies that gouge families of prisoners by charging them exorbitant rates to communicate with their loved ones, gun manufacturers that sell taser guns, rifles, and pistols to prison guards and police, private health care providers contracted by the state to provide typically abysmal health care to prisoners, the U.S. military, which relies on prison labor to provide military gear to soldiers in Iraq, corporations that use prison labor to avoid paying decent wages, and the politicians, lawyers, and bankers who structure deals to build new prisons, often in predominantly white rural communities, deals that often promise far more to local communities than they deliver. All of these corporate and political interests have a stake in the expansion, not the elimination, of the system of mass incarceration. Consider also the lengthy to-do list for reformers. If we become serious about dismantling the system of mass incarceration, we must end the war on drugs. There's no way around it. The drug war is largely responsible for the prison boom and the creation of the new undercaste, and there's no path to liberation for communities of color that includes this ongoing war. So long as people of color in ghetto communities are being rounded up by the thousands for drug offenses, carted off to prisons, and then released into a permanent undercaste, mass incarceration as a system of control will continue to function well. Ending the drug war is no simple task, however. It cannot be accomplished through a landmark court decision, an executive order, or a single stroke of the presidential pen. Since 1982, the war has raged like a forest fire, set with a few matches and a gallon of gasoline. What began as an audacious federal program has spread to every state in the nation and nearly every city. It has infected law enforcement activities on roads, sidewalks, highways, train stations, airports, and the nation's border. The war has effectively shredded portions of the U.S. Constitution, eliminating Fourth Amendment protections once deemed inviolate, and it has militarized policing practices in inner cities across America. Racially targeted drug law enforcement practices, taken together with laws that specifically discriminate against drug offenders in employment, housing, and public benefits, have relegated the majority of black men in urban areas across the United States to a permanent second-class status. If we hope to end this system of control, we cannot be satisfied with a handful of reforms. All of the financial incentives granted to law enforcement to arrest poor black and brown people for drug offenses must be revoked. Federal grant money for drug enforcement must end. Drug forfeiture laws must be stripped from the books. Racial profiling must be eradicated. The concentration of drug busts in poor communities of color must cease. And the transfer of military equipment and aid to local law enforcement agencies waging the drug war must come to a screeching halt. And that's just for starters. Equally important, there must be a change within the culture of law enforcement. Black and brown people in ghetto communities must no longer be viewed as the designated enemy, and ghetto communities must no longer be treated like occupied zones. Law enforcement must adopt a compassionate, humane approach to the problems of the urban poor, an approach that goes beyond the rhetoric of community policing, to a method of engagement that promotes trust, healing, and genuine partnership. Data collection for police and prosecutors should be mandated nationwide to ensure that selective enforcement is no longer taking place. Racial impact statements that assess the racial and ethnic impact of criminal justice legislation must be adopted. Public defender offices should be funded at the same level as prosecutors' offices to eliminate the unfair advantage afforded the incarceration machine. The list goes on. Mandatory drug sentencing laws must be rescinded. Marijuana ought to be legalized, and perhaps other drugs as well. Meaningful re-entry programs must be adopted, programs that provide a pathway not just to dead-end minimum wage jobs, but also training and education so those labeled criminals can realistically reach for high-paying jobs and viable, rewarding career paths. prison workers should be retrained for jobs and careers that do not involve caging human beings. Drug treatment on demand must be provided for all Americans, a far better investment of taxpayer money than prison cells for drug offenders. Barriers to re-entry, specifically the myriad laws that operate to discriminate against drug offenders for the rest of their lives in every aspect of their social, economic, and political life, must be eliminated. The list could go on, of course, but the point has been made. The central question for racial justice advocates is this: are we serious about ending this system of control or not? If we are, there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. The notion that all of these reforms can be accomplished piecemeal, one at a time, through disconnected advocacy strategies, seems deeply misguided. All of the needed reforms have less to do with failed policies than a deeply flawed public consensus, one that is indifferent at best to the experience of poor people of color. As Martin Luther King Jr. explained back in 1965 when describing why it was far more important to engage in mass mobilizations than file lawsuits, "We're trying to win the right to vote, and we have to focus the attention of the world on that. We can't do that making legal cases. We have to make the case in the court of public opinion." King certainly appreciated the contributions of civil rights lawyers. He relied on them to get him out of jail. But he opposed the tendency of civil rights lawyers to identify a handful of individuals who could make great plaintiffs in a court of law, then file isolated cases. He believed what was necessary was to mobilize thousands to make their case in the court of public opinion. In his view, it was a flawed public consensus, not merely flawed policy, that was at the root of racial oppression. Today, no less than 50 years ago, a flawed public consensus lies at the core of the prevailing caste system. When people think about crime, especially drug crime, they do not think about suburban housewives violating laws regulating prescription drugs or white frat boys using ecstasy. Drug crime in this country is understood to be black and brown, and it is because drug crime is racially defined in the public consciousness that the electorate has not cared much what happens to drug criminals, at least not the way they would have cared if the criminals were understood to be white. It is this failure to care, really care, across color lines, that lies at the core of this system of control and every racial caste system that has existed in the United States or anywhere else in the world. Those who believe that advocacy challenging mass incarceration can be successful without overturning the public consensus that gave rise to it are engaging in fanciful thinking, a form of denial. Isolated victories can be won, even a string of victories, but in the absence of a fundamental shift in public consciousness, the system as a whole will remain intact. To the extent that major changes are achieved without a complete shift, the system will rebound. The caste system will reemerge in a new form, just as convict leasing replaced slavery, or it will be reborn as mass incarceration replaced Jim Crow. Sociologists Michael Omi and Howard Winant make a similar point in their book Racial Formation in the United States. They attribute the cyclical nature of racial progress to the unstable equilibrium that characterizes the United States' racial order. Under normal conditions, they argue, state institutions are able to normalize the organization and enforcement of the prevailing racial order, and the system functions relatively automatically. Challenges to the racial order during these periods are easily marginalized or suppressed, and the prevailing system of racial meanings, identity, and ideology seems natural. These conditions clearly prevailed during slavery and Jim Crow. When the equilibrium is disrupted, however, as in Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Movement, the state initially resists, then attempts to absorb the challenge through a series of reforms that are, if not entirely symbolic, at least not critical to the operation of the racial order. In the absence of a truly egalitarian racial consensus, these predictable cycles inevitably give rise to new, extraordinarily comprehensive systems of racialized social control. One example of the way in which a well-established racial order easily absorbs legal challenges is the infamous aftermath of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. After the Supreme Court declared separate schools inherently unequal in 1954, segregation persisted unabated. One commentator notes, "The statistics from the southern states are truly amazing. For 10 years, 1954 to 1964, virtually nothing happened. Not a single black child attended an integrated public grade school
in South Carolina, Alabama, or Mississippi as of the 1962-1963 school year. Across the South as a whole, a mere 1% of black school children were attending school with whites in 1964, a full decade after Brown was decided. Brown did not end Jim Crow. A mass movement had to emerge first, one that aimed to create a new public consensus opposed to the evils of Jim Crow. This does not mean Brown v. Board was meaningless, as some commentators have claimed. Brown gave critical legitimacy to the demands of civil rights activists who risked their lives to end Jim Crow, and it helped to inspire the movement as well as a fierce backlash. But standing alone, Brown accomplished for African Americans little more than Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. A civil war had to be waged to end slavery. A mass movement was necessary to bring a formal end to Jim Crow. Those who imagine that far less is required to dismantle mass incarceration and build a new egalitarian racial consensus, reflecting a compassionate rather than punitive impulse toward poor people of color, fail to appreciate the distance between Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream and the ongoing racial nightmare for those locked up and locked out of American society. The foregoing should not be read as a call for movement building to the exclusion of reform work. To the contrary, reform work is the work of movement building, provided that it's done consciously as a movement building work. If all the reforms mentioned above were actually adopted, a radical transformation in our society would have taken place. The relevant question is not whether to engage in reform work, but how. There's no shortage of worthy reform efforts and goals. Differences of opinion are inevitable about which reforms are most important and in what order of priority they should be pursued. These debates are worthwhile, but it is critical to keep in mind that the question of how we do reform work is even more important than the specific reforms we seek. If the way we pursue reforms does not contribute to the building of a movement to dismantle the system of mass incarceration, and if our advocacy does not upset the prevailing public consensus that supports the new caste system, none of the reforms, even if won, will successfully disrupt the nation's racial equilibrium. Challenges to the system will be easily absorbed or deflected, and the accommodations made will serve primarily to legitimate the system, not undermine it. We run the risk of winning isolated battles, but losing the larger war.